On our desert island this week is one of the great actors of our time, Sir John Gielgud. Sir John, I know that music means a lot to you because you've produced opera, and I've seen you in several plays in which you've played the piano excellently.
Well, I don't play the piano at all, really. My father played very charmingly. He improvised on quite ambitious classical themes sometimes. And when I was a boy, he used to play all the big motifs from The Ring and give me the Shaw book, The Perfect Wagner Right, to read. And took me, when I was very young, to see, I think, Valkyrie and Rheingold under Beecham, I think, probably at Drury Lane or somewhere. But anyhow, he sort of inculcated quite a taste for music, and I was able to copy his skill in improvising a little bit, though I never learned to read music at all. Mm-hmm. And then I got a gramophone when I was about 11 or 12 and began to buy records for myself. And the first record that I bought and fell in love with was this record of Kreisler and Zimbalist jogging to here. And I'd seen Fritz Kreisler give a recital also with my father taking me at the Albert Hall. And he made an enormous impression upon me. He had such charm, and he took his call in the most wonderfully gracious and dignified way. And the tone of his violin as he put it to his shoulder was absolutely extraordinary, I thought. And I bought this record and played it continually. And my mother, who was not very musical and was not at all ashamed of owning it, came into the nursery and said, "Oh, I like that thing you're playing all the time, but I own it, do so wish they'd catch each other up."
The opening of the Bach Concerto for two violins in D minor, Fritz Kreisler and Ephraim Zimbalist, a recording, I see, made as long ago as 1915. Now, you have sung more than once in a production, haven't you?
Well, only once, really. Michael Redgrave, who was playing Macheath in a revival of The Beggar's Opera at the beginning of the war, which I had directed for Glyndebourne at the Haymarket Theatre in London, got ill. And the understudy was also ill or couldn't go on. And I, having directed the play and known it terribly well from seeing it over and over again at the Lyric Hammersmith with Frederick Ranelagh, volunteered to go on for a few nights. And I remember we rehearsed all the weekend, and I knew the dialogue pretty well and the tunes. And when I couldn't get a top note, I stamped my foot and clenched my fist in the air, which somebody assured me was what all singers did when they couldn't reach the top note. And I went up and apologized to the chorus because I had made a terrible mess of one of the ensemble numbers, and they were all so surprised that I had gone up to apologize. It wasn't the custom at all, and it made a great impression. And I also was paid, I remember, in money. When I got back to my dressing room, there was money on the table for my salary, which was quite a lot. I think it was £100 or something for two nights. And I was terribly proud of that. I thought I'd never been paid like Sarah Bernhardt in coin before. But that was the only time I've ever attempted to sing.
I believe there's theatre blood on both sides of your family.
Yes, my father's family was Lithuanian, and his grandmother was a quite famous actress.
And, of course, Ellen Terry was your great aunt.
My mother's family were all actors and actresses, and very wonderful ones, too. And it was a great responsibility, and it helped me very much to get jobs, I'm afraid, when I was young, when I was beginning. But it also was very difficult to live up to, because I think people expected a great deal of me. And I was rather conceited and inefficient, and it took me 10 or 15 years to find how difficult acting was and to calm myself down and not show off so much.
Did you take it for granted that you were going into the theatre?
No. My parents wanted me to be an architect, and I was mad about drawing, and I was mad on Gordon Craig because he was my cousin and because I was fascinated by his designs. And then I discovered I would have to learn blueprints and mathematics, at which I was very bad. And I was supposed to be going to Oxford when I left Westminster School. But I said to my parents, well, let me try something on the stage if I can get a scholarship. And if I don't do well by the time I'm 25, I'll go back to architecture and learn the mathematics. But I did well enough to encourage me to go on as an actor, though it wasn't my first thought. But Craig influenced me very, very much. And he designed, with great success, a production of Dido and Aeneas of Purcell, which he did at Hampstead Swiss Cottage or somewhere before my time, in 1903 or something like that. And it made a great success, and I've seen a great many drawings of it. And I always loved the opera very much. And I saw a very beautiful production at the Mermaid Theatre when it was in Acacia Road, which Bernard Miles very daringly put on with Kirstin Flagstadt and Maggie Tate, when he had a sort of garden theatre there. And I fell very much in love again with the opera, which I'd never seen before. And it's the one opera that if anybody asked me ever to direct an opera again, I would like to have a shot at, because I think it's such a lovely work. It's so extraordinary to think that it was written for a girls' school. But that's why I chose this record of Janet Baker singing the beautiful aria at the end of the opera.
Janet Baker as Dido in Purcell's Dido in Aeneas. What was your very first appearance on the professional stage?
I walked on as a unpaid student at the Old Vic in a production of Henry V, about 1921. A lot of us went and asked for jobs there, and they couldn't pay you, of course. And I carried a spear, and in Henry V I came on and said, here are the numbers of the slaughtered French, which was my only line.
You got it right.
I don't know whether I did, but I was in four productions there as a student, and I saw Russell Thorndike play these great parts, King Lear and Peer Gynt and Hamlet. In successive weeks, he always was word perfect, and the company was a very shoddy, shabby one.
Was that in Robert Atkins's day?
Yes, it was. He was terrifying, I thought, and so were the old actors who worked in his company, were real old laddies from the provinces, you know. But it was an extraordinary atmosphere there, and old Lillian Bailey sort of plumping about as an old landlady. So when I went back there to play leading parts 10 years later. It was rather thrilling, really, to remember that one had been there at one's very beginning.
What was the first time you acted for money?
For my cousin, Phyllis Nielsen Terry, I was assistant stage manager for a tour she did of a play called The Wheel, which she'd done in London, by J.B. Fagan, who afterwards was my boss at the Oxford Repertory Playhouse. Mm-hmm. And I had a tiny part and did assistant stage manager and general dog's body. We did a long 12-week tour. She was a great star in those days. And she was very kind to me, and she really started me off.
The year you had at the Oxford Playhouse, the repertory must have been very useful.
Well, that was wonderful, because for the first time I played in The Cherry Orchard and Love for Love and Captain Brass Band and Mana Vanna and some Spanish plays.
Yes.
I was there about 3 terms, I think, and we did a play every week, so I did about 15 or 16 plays in that mm-hmm. year. And from that, I came to London and understudied Noel Coward in The Vortex.
That was one of your first commercial successes. You had already played Romeo at a very early age.
Yes, in 19, with Gwen Franken Davis at the Regent Theatre, which is now pulled down near King's Cross. But I've played Romeo 3 times, and never with any great satisfaction. I think it's the most difficult part. And Laurence Olivier beat me hollow in it when we alternated Romeo and Mercutio together in 1935 when we did the play.
Well, going back to your return to the Old Vic when you played the Shakespeare leads for Lillian Bayliss, how much were you paid?
£10 the first year and 20 the second, I think. I think so. I know she had a fit, but I knew I must be a success because she doubled the salary the second year, and nobody had ever heard of anybody getting as much as that. Yeah. She really was a terrible skinflint. And I think we had £15 to spend on each production, and they used to use the same pillars and benches and old curtains, and people used to give bits of scenery. Matheson Lang or somebody who'd been on tour gave their props. Edith Evans gave the whole of a play called Delilah, which had been a failure. She gave all the scenery to the Vic. So they used to make do, but it was a terrible business because the wardrobe also supplied the opera, and so great jealousies went on whether they'd give you the cloak that was needed by the leading soprano next week for some great operatic part, or whether you could have it for a Shakespeare play instead or for as well.
And you acted with Ralph Richardson there?
I met him there in the second year I was there,
yeah.
And we became friends and have been ever since.
And you played Lear at that time?
Yes, I did, when I was 25, 26, and it was a very exciting effort. I couldn't say more than that.
Let's have your third record. What shall that be?
Well, it's the Walk to Paradise Garden out of Delius's Village Romeo and Juliet. I once saw it, and I can't remember where. I became very fond of Delius because my father liked his music very much and was a great devotee of Beecham, who also, of course, was so enthusiastic always about Mozart and Delius. And I remember also going to the great anniversary performance. I suppose it was his 50th year or some anniversary, which was the last time Delius himself appeared in London in the old Queen's Hall. It must have been before the war, of course. And I saw him sitting up there in the circle, and there was a very beautiful program. And since then, I've always been a great admirer of his music, and I find it soothing and romantic.
Walk to the Paradise Garden from the Delius opera, A Village, Romeo and Juliet, Sir Thomas Beecham conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Sir John, you went very successfully into management yourself at the Queen's Theatre.
Yes, I did it there, and I did it in the Haymarket during the last year of the war, and again at the Lyric Hammersmith in 1953. So three times I've been in management, but the first time was my own money, and we made a little money, which was an extraordinary thing at that time, because we did four productions in a year. The other two were backed by tenants and were pretty successful, both of them.
Do you like the administrative side?
No, I was always grateful to have all the money side done for me by somebody else, and I have no idea of business and money at all.
One of your less successful roles was Shylock, and you said that's because you don't think you're good at unsympathetic roles. Do you believe that's right?
Well, I don't think it's quite true. I'm rather good at prigs and bores, and I'm rather proud of the fact that I can play rather dull men and make them seem rather more amusing, perhaps. But what I mean is that in personality, one seems to have a rather fastidious, rather haughty manner, which was rather difficult to fit. I could never play, I'm sure, successfully low-life parts. In fact, there's a record of me with Ralph Richardson and Orson Welles doing a Sherlock Holmes thing, which we did once, in which I had to be Cockney and say, oh, bring up the coal, matey, or something, and it turned out to be Sherlock Holmes, which people used to play at parties as a joke against me, because they said I was so bad. And I'm sure I could never be any good at dialect or convincing anybody that I was a navvy or a farmer or even I enjoy very much playing servants, playing, you know, butlers and valets and clergymen and that kind of thing. But I can't get much onto the manual worker because I've never been one and I don't think I ever shall be now.
Now, for people of my generation, your Hamlet was the definitive one, and rightly you were in a number of productions. I remember one was to mourn the demolition of Irving's theatre, the Lyceum.
Yes, that was a strange production. We did it at Elsinore, and it was right on the eve of the war, and we had the feeling when we got to Denmark that there was terrible trouble afoot, and they seemed very nervous themselves there. And although I didn't follow politics as I ought to have done, I did realise how bad things were. I'd had a year in Dear Octopus, which opened on the eve of Munich, and I remember Noel Coward coming to the party afterwards and shaking his head and saying how dreadful everything was, and we were all rather rejoicing that Chamberlain had managed to put the war off for a year. Mm-hmm. But it was a strange farewell. It wasn't my farewell Hamlet, because I did it again at the end of the war in 1944.
At the Haymarket.
Yes, but I was beginning to feel that I was getting a bit old for it, and I think I was very tired by that time. And the Elsinore castle is not, to my mind, at all ideal. Very disappointing when you get there. It's a great big stone courtyard, and we had bad weather. And it was a funny feeling in the company that we were all being separated. I had a company of many of whom I'd worked for on and off for about 10 years. And there was a feeling like the end of term. One somehow knew that we were all going to be separated. And people had mad practical jokes and threw each other into the sea and put booby traps over the door, and somebody put a cannon in somebody's bed. I mean, most idiotic schoolboy things. But I think it was this feeling of danger and of suspense, yes, that we were all going through at that time.
There was a little bit of trouble because somebody stole some Nazi flags.
That's
from the
right,
hotel
and
destroyed
them down the toilet, certainly.
Let's have your fourth record.
The fourth record is a Mahler sung by the beautiful Kathleen Ferrier, who died so young. And not only is it wonderful music to me, I came to it very late, but I have such a touching recollection of seeing her performance of Orpheus at Covent Garden, the last one she gave before she was taken desperately ill and died. And shortly before that, she had a slight respite from her illness. And some people took a flat for her in Hamilton Terrace and took me round one afternoon to meet her. And she was sitting in bed in a pink dressing gown, so charming and so easy and like a lovely Lancashire lass, something of Gracie Fields' charm. And we talked together, and Ruth Draper was there. And it's an afternoon that I shall always remember with great affection and great nostalgia, because you could see what a remarkable lady she was. And her voice, of course, was exquisite.
Kathleen Ferrier singing The Farewell from Mahler's The Song of the Earth. We've been talking about your early days in the theatre. It's interesting to think how much the theatre has changed since those pre-war days, the arrival of the subsidised theatre. What's been your experience of working in those great organisations now with lots
of administrators? Well, I must say, I'm devoted to Peter Hall, who I admire greatly, and who was a very, very kind and helpful director to me in two or three plays. But I did work for a year at the National Theatre, not in very satisfactory parts.
Yes.
Then I did a play called Half-Life by Julian Mitchell, a new writer, at the Cottesloe, which was rather fun and which was successful enough to be moved to the Duke of York's, where it ran for a year. So that was a rather a nice change. And we also did No Man's Land, which was an enormous success. Before the National Theatre opened, we did it at the Vic, and then later we did it again at the National. And that was a great experience, and I loved working in the play. It was a magnificent part. I was working with Richardson, who I love. So that was a great chance to play a different kind of work, just as at the Royal Court when I did Home and Bingo and Veterans. That was another sort of avant-garde adventure. But Richardson and I are both slightly heretical, I think, about very nouveau, very avant-garde writers. And when we did Home and No Man's Land, we both trembled like aspen leaves and had to kind of back each other up to persuade each other that we weren't going to make absolute fools of ourselves. But with the help of Lindsay Anderson and Peter Hall, who directed the two plays, they both came out very, very successfully.
Let's have your fifth record.
The Liebeslieder of Brahms, which I also came to very late. I heard it only a few years ago. There was a performance made into a ballet in New York by Balanchine, of course, who is a genius, with two pianos on the stage, and these enchanting waltzes. And I fell very much in love with it, and when I bought the record, I found I played it a great deal. It's light, and it's melodious, and it takes you back to the kind of romance of youth when I used to dance a great deal in the 20s, you know, and go to nightclubs. And I think these waltzes have a lot of style and a lot of charm, and they're prettily sung as well. So I thought they would be nice to have with me.
One of the Brahms' Neue Liebeslieder, Opus 65, An jeder Hand, sung by Irmgard Seefried. One of your most successful endeavours was your one-man show, The Seven Ages of Man. You had great success with that all over the world.
Yes, well, I did, and it was a kind of experimental thing. George Rylands, who's at King's College, Cambridge, is a great Shakespearean, has always directed a great many plays and acted when he was a young man. And he directed, in my season at the Haymarket at the end of the war, he directed Hamlet and The Duchess of Malfi for me. Mm. So when he produced an anthology called Ages of Man, and I looked through it, I suddenly thought it would be an interesting thing to try and put some of the speeches together that I liked particularly and thought seemed to be effective, and to make a pattern of them and make a recital of it. And I did it for societies, and I did someone performs with Julian Bream and with musicians helping me at various Old Lady Astor's house in St. James's Square and at the Queen Elizabeth Hall. And then finally I decided I would try and really make it into a professional thing, and I did a 13-week tour of America, beginning in Canada, with one-night stands mostly, which was a tremendous bore, really, but I learned how to do it because I changed the items every night. So I did work on it very hard, and it was so successful by the end of the 13 weeks that I took it to New York, where it succeeded beyond my expectations, and then I did it again in London. But I have done it in many places. The last time I ever did it was when we were doing the Charge of the Light Brigade in Turkey, and I did a performance for the English Library in Ankara before we went home, and it was very successful. But I haven't done it since, and I would dread doing it again, because I'd had about 8 years out of it one way and another.
Right, record number six, please.
Well, I wanted to have an old friend's voice with me on the island, and so nobody could be better than Ralph Richardson. And these poems of Blake have a great charm for me, and he has such a beautiful voice and such warmth of personality that I felt he would be a great comfort to me if I was without anybody to talk to.
Which ones do you choose?
I chose The Chimney Sweeper and The Sick Rose.
When my mother died, I was very young, and my father sold me, while yet my tongue could scarcely cry, weep, 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 weep. So your chimneys I sweep, and in soot I sleep. There's little Tom Dacre, who cried when his head, that curled like a lamb's back, was shaved. So I said, hush, Tom, never mind it, for when your head's bare, you know that the soot cannot spoil your white hair. And so he was quiet. And that very night, as Tom was asleeping, he had such a sight that thousands of sweepers, Dick, Joe, Ned and Jack, were all of them locked up in coffins of black. And by came an angel who had a bright key, and he opened the coffins and set them all free. Then down a green plain, leaping, laughing, they run and wash in the river and shine in the sun. Then, naked and white, all their bags left behind, they rise upon clouds and sport in the wind. And the angel told Tom, if he'd be a good boy, he'd have God for his father and never want joy. And so Tom awoke. And we rose in the dark and got with our bags and our brushes to work. Though the morning was cold, Tom was happy and warm. So if all do their duty, they need not fear harm. O Rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night, in the howling storm, has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy.
Two poems by William Blake, read by Ralph Richardson, The Chimney Sweeper and The Sick Rose. Sir John, we've been concentrating on your theatre work. Until fairly recently, films didn't mean much to you.
No, I made quite a number. I made even a couple of silent films.
Yes.
And then I made The Good Companions film, and I did The Secret Agent with Hitchcock in 1935.
Mm. How did you get on with Hitchcock?
Very, very well. It was quite fun in a way, but it was awfully exhausting because I was playing at night. I was playing Romeo and Juliet at night, which I had directed and which I was alternating Romeo and Mercutio with Olivier. So I don't know how I did the work, really. I got up and went to Lime Grove at about 7 in the morning and then rushed off to the theatre about 5:30 and slept for half an hour and went on. It wasn't much fun. But when Tony Richardson asked me to be in The Loved One in California,
mm-hmm.
and then The Charge of the Light Brigade, he found a sort of film personality for me, which was really something quite new for me. And I hadn't any theatre work to worry about at the same time. I'd always been torn between the two. And I turned down a lot of very interesting offers. When I was working hard in the theatre, I called offered to do Hamlet for me, which I turned down, and I was approached to do Caesar and Cleopatra with Vivian Leigh, the Shaw play, which I also turned down, because I was rather contemptuous of films, and I didn't think I was any good in them. When I saw the performance, I thought I was awfully bad and affected and so on. So I didn't try. But when I started again with these films, The Light Brigade and Loved One, I suddenly found much more ease with the camera, and I wasn't worried about being good-looking anymore. So I settled down to it, and now I enjoy it very much indeed.
You had a great success in a rather strange film by Alain René, Providence.
I did, and that was a wonderful experience because he's a great director, although he doesn't speak much English. But it was a very fascinating script by David Mercer, who sadly died a few months ago. And the moment I read it, I was very thrilled that they'd asked me to do it because it was much more coarse and strong than anything I had usually played in the theatre. I had to play a lot of drunk scenes, which I would never dream to do on the stage because I can't play drunk. But I had a lot of scenes in bed throwing bottles about and making obscene remarks, which I found, with his help, I managed to do without much self-consciousness. I could never have done them in the theatre, funnily enough.
And you've been in Caligula. That's got some rather broad effects, too.
Well, I wasn't very proud of that, really, but it was a harmless little part in which I got bumped off very early on. And it was rather amusing to be there with all the nude people who, the moment the bell went for lunch, rushed, clutching their hands in front of them, into the corridor to have pizza with their families.
Are you writing? You've done several volumes of autobiography.
Yes, I have done. I've done four books, actually. And the one I wrote last year, which was done from some radio interviews I did with John Miller. In fact, I did 12 of them, and then I did four more last year. Four publishers offered to make a book of it, and I warned them that it would not be easy because they were very colloquial and badly written. I mean, they were meant to be spoken. Mm-hmm. But they were very patient and did a very good job on it, I think. And it has been liked by people. And I wanted to put all these stories and memories and things down before I forgot them, because I have a frightfully good recall at the moment. One never knows how long one's memory will remain as good as that. And so it was fun to do, going back on old times and mentioning a lot of people who I was very fond of and who I admired very much. And I did enjoy it on the whole.
We've got to record number 7.
We had to have something from Mozart, and there's so much to choose from. I fell in love with Mozart in the 30s when I went to Glyndebourne and saw all the operas for the first time, I expect. And since then, I've seen most of them many times. I do enjoy them enormously, and also his orchestral music. In fact, I play so much Mozart that I don't know which to choose. And I chose this movement from the Clarinet Concerto because it's one of my favorites. But there are dozens and dozens that I love equally well.
The opening of the last movement of the Mozart Clarinet Concerto in A Major, Jack Brymer as soloist, with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham. Now, a number of your friends and colleagues who have been on this programme have recounted with glee and great affection their favourite story about you dropping bricks. Have you any favourite instance yourself that you'd care to tell?
Oh, there are a number. I can never think of them at the right moment. But it's perfectly true. I make the most terrible mistakes and gaffes sometimes. But I suppose the most famous one is there was a very nice man called Edward Knobloch, who was very kind to me as a young man. He wrote a very successful play called Kismet, which was a huge success, and worked with Arnold Bennett on Milestones. And he was very charming, and I used to know him very well. And that towards the end of his life, he was very unsuccessful. I think lost all his money. And we were lunching at the Ivy one day, and he said he had 25 unpublished plays in his top drawer or something, and he talked on and on. And I said about somebody else, I said, he's almost as big a bore as Eddie Knobloch, to his face. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether I'd said it or whether I hadn't said it. But I know I did say it. I can hear myself saying it now. I do hope he wasn't too upset, because he was a very nice man.
Oh, dear. Yes, it's so easy to do. Now, you're on this island. How good would you be at looking after yourself? Are you a practical person?
Not at all. I wouldn't. I can't boil a kettle or an egg. I'm quite helpless. Oh, always have been.
You couldn't rig up a...
I would have to learn.
Would you try to get back again? Would you try to make a raft or...
No, I don't think so. I'd probably rather happy though.
Your last record, what's that?
Well, it sounds rather solemn and religious, which it's a beautiful piece from the Fourier Requiem, which recently I had the pleasure of working on in Winchester Cathedral. I did the prayers in it and the narration at the beginning. And I'd already got this record from King's College, Cambridge, which is a most beautiful record. And I thought it would make a fitting end to this program.
Part of In Paradisum from the Fourier Requiem, the choir of King's College, Cambridge, conducted by David Wilcox. If you could take only one disc out of the eight you've played us, which would it be?
I think I would take the Bach, because I think it would be less likely to become monotonous.
The Bach Double Violin Concerto. Mm. And you are allowed one book apart from the Bible and Shakespeare to take with you.
A book of crosswords and a dictionary to go with them, because I couldn't have both. But I'm torn between that and the works of Proust, which I feel it's my duty to read.
Well, you can certainly have like A La Recherche. I mean, that's one book.
Well, I'd want the whole lot.
Yes.
And now that they're so expensive to buy in the new version, it would be nice to be given it.
You want it in English?
Oh, yes, I couldn't read it in French.
Right. Proust, and thank you, Sir John Gielgud, for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you very much for asking me. I've enjoyed it very much.
Goodbye, everyone.